Hi, everybody, and welcome to Heathen Hour. We have two amazing guests with us today. Before we get started, I just wanted to let you know that we do have a new channel that we are going to be posting all of our live streams on. So this podcast will now be on the Heathen Hour channel. The link for it is in the description. So please go subscribe to the Heathen Hour channel. We are ultimately going to be moving these live broadcasts to that channel as well. So if you want to keep up, that is the best way to do it, because we won't be streaming on the Godless Cranium channel for too much longer. Also, all of our previous videos have been moved, so they're no longer on this channel. If you're looking for something that is in our archive, you'll have to go to the Heathen Hour channel. They are all up there. So obviously watch this first, but as soon as we are done, go and subscribe to the Heathen Hour. If you want to rewatch this, that's where it is going to be. So tonight we are in for an interesting discussion. We have two really amazing guests. Before we get started, I'm going to give you guys both an opportunity to introduce yourself. So we will go ladies first. So first I would like to introduce SJ Thomason. So SJ, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and where they can find you.
Hi, I'm SJ Thomason. I'm located in Tampa, Florida, actually. And so you can find me on Twitter at LEAD Lead 1225, or you can find me in my blog at Christian-apologist.com. I'm a university professor. I teach human resource management and leadership classes primarily. And I like publishing on things that have to do with ethics. Actually, lately I've been focusing a lot on ethics and looking at like the multidimensional ethics scale and different ethical frameworks. And so I've been working toward that end. And so I think that tonight's discussion should be a lot of fun.
Awesome, SJ, thank you. And the next guest that we have would be Dr. Richard Carrier. So Richard, why don't you introduce yourself to everybody? Let them know where they can find you.
I'm Richard Carrier. I have a PhD in ancient intellectual history, and I write and blog. I first published on this, which actually is my first book, this subject, Sense and Goodness Without God. And since then, I've published a peer-reviewed chapter on meta-ethical theory, which is what we'll be talking about today. And that was released in the anthology, The End of Christianity. And I've blogged on it a lot as well. And people can find all my writings, books, blog articles, and all my social media if you want to connect that way. Find my courses online and all of that stuff. That's available at richardcarrier.info. That's .info.
Thank you both very much. So in order to get started, we are not going to have a super formal debate. This is mostly going to be a dialogue between the two of you. And the subject, as everybody knows, is going to be whether you need God for morality. So I would like to start off by just getting each of you to kind of briefly define what your definition, I suppose, of morality or conception of morality would be. So this time I'd like to start with you, Richard, if you would like to take the floor for a moment.
Sure. I think fundamentally, moral facts are what we ought to do above all else. So they're basically the imperatives that supersede all other imperative statements. And my view of this is that the only imperative statements we've ever been able to confirm are true by any means are hypothetical imperatives, meaning if you want to accomplish a certain goal, you have to do certain things because of the way the world works, the way the world is built, the way you were built, and so on. So true moral facts for me are the facts of what you most ought to do that follow from the true facts of the world, which includes the psychology of the people you're talking about and the behavior of social systems that they have to interact with. And it all derives from what people really want most to be self-satisfied with their lives in light of the truth rather than false beliefs. So in light of how the world actually works and what actually is true about the world.
Thank you very much, Richard. So SJ, if you would like to just give us a brief synopsis of what your conceptualization of morality would be.
Okay, the first thing I want to say is I think your question was, can people be moral without God? And I would like to just address that first before I go into what my definition is. And I'll say yes, you're moral. For example, Shannon, I know that you do a lot of really good things for society. And I know that you act in a moral way and you carry yourself in a moral way. And you don't believe in God. So so I do believe that we can have moral atheists. I think that's completely possible. I'm sure Richard and Godless Cranium, I'm sure, I don't know you two as well. I've interacted a lot more with Shannon, but I'm sure you are too. So that's speaking to that. Now, to the idea of morality, actually, Richard and I read one of his articles on objective morality, and he and I have some of the same beliefs on that kind of stuff. We both believe that there is an objective moral standard and duties. So at least I think that's the way he's saying. He's saying there's an objective morality. I'll say that we have objective moral standards and duties to do what's right. And as he just mentioned, to do what we ought to do. And so I'll look at what the standards are. And that basically standards include truth, which he mentioned. Equality is a standard. Equity is another standard. Love is a standard. Liberty is a standard. And if we go all the way back to what Thomas Jefferson said, he said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And he grounded that those standards under God. And that's where I believe that that we stand, that Richard and I have a difference in opinion, is I believe that these standards are grounded in God. They're transcendental. They transcend generations and cultures. And it's pretty interesting that they also can't be explained by something like biological evolution, because biological evolution only explains what is. It doesn't explain what ought to be.
Okay, so perhaps in order to, for the sake of being a little more clear, I'll reword the question. Can you have morality? Like, can we have morality without God, as opposed to can we be moral without God, would be a better way to frame the question. So thank you for elucidating that for me, because I wasn't as clear as I should have been. So I guess my first question would be posed to SJ, and then Richard, perhaps you can jump in as you have questions as well. And same to you, Mike. Why do you need a God to have those standards? Why can't we strive to be what you would classify as good without God?
So again, I think that we do, all humans, here's how it works. So if we go back and look at what biology does explain, for example, people have a predisposition to have certain personalities based on their parents. So I have a predisposition to have, depending on if my parents have certain levels of what they call the five-factor model of personality, where they stand in those dimensions, I have a predisposition to have those same personality characteristics. But going beyond that, we take a look at, and that's at the individual level, we could take a look at your culture and say that in some cultures, you probably are more likely, or it's more probable, that you'll endorse particular cultural values. For example, some of the studies that have been out there, like by Robert House, who was the leader of the Globe study of 62 different societies, Shalom Schwartz, who's out of Israel, and he's done studies cross-culturally, and another one I'll just quickly mention is Gert Hofstede, and he's also done studies of cultures. They've all determined that that some of the values that are prevalent within cultures are very much related to the fact that you're born in that culture. So, for example, the desire, according to Shalom Schwartz, for self-enhancement versus self-transcendence is something that we see that varies across cultures. So in the United States, if you're born here, we're more likely to have a high level of self-enhancement values, which relate to hedonism, actually, and a desire for pleasure. If you're born in places like in Southeast Asia, you're more likely to have self-transcendent values. And so you're more likely to value things like benevolence and universalism. So at the cultural value, we can see that. But then we all have this really interesting thing, and that's why I brought up House, is there's also this really interesting thing, which is what is in a society, for example, here in the United States, our desire for hedonism, doesn't necessarily correspond to what ought to be. So we're hedonists here in the United States, yet we know that we really ought to be more self-transcendent. So it's kind of an interesting thing that all over the world, no matter where you're born, these ought to be values are prevalent, and they transcend generations. It's not something that, when we say it's an objective value, it means that it doesn't fluctuate as a function of our opinions. We ought to do the right thing. We call it just doing the right thing. And so that's where I say that has to be grounded in something that's transcendental. It's not grounded in a personality. There's no person who perfectly represents any of these standards that I just mentioned. So God is the answer for that.
I was just going to ask what you mean by transcendent.
Go ahead. Transcendent in this particular instance, I'm using it just as transcends cultures. So it transcends generations and cultures. It goes beyond that, if you want to just say that.
So it seems like you're suggesting because there are things that we all, I guess, sort of innately understand are oughts, therefore they must have been imbued upon us by something outside of us. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist within us universally. Is that a decent synopsis?
Yeah, right. That sounds fair.
Okay. Richard, do you think that you might have an opportunity to kind of speak towards that with her agreeing that that synopsis is fair as the basis?
I could read something that actually answers a lot of that. Because the first thing that was an interesting definition of transcendent is anything that transcends cultures. And I agree with that. In fact, the facts that transcend culture in this case are human biology, the physics of the world, and the behavior of social systems, which these are universal truths. And any social system that's organized a certain way will act a certain way and have certain outcomes, especially in conjunction with human psychology, which is a biological universal that gets modified by culture. And the modifications affect how you're going to organize a social system. So the moral theories we've been tinkering around with throughout time are all just human inventions to try and find what is the best way we can all behave that results in the best outcomes for everybody, for all of us. It gives us the society we want to live in. And I think that's where the transcendent facts are the natural facts of the universe. You don't actually need a god to explain any of that.
So SJ, did you hear what Richard was just saying there? So he's essentially using biology and psychology in order to say that, you know, the things that we strive towards can be innate with us and explained using that as the metric. What would your response be to that?
So I think Richard, I want to see if I can get clarification on that. Can you explain that you just said that, we're looking at basic, I mean, I can see the standard. You're saying the best way we can treat each other. Is that what you're saying? That if we had to, how would you ground this? How would you say that, I mean, how can we assess exactly what is the best way? How would you determine that?
Yeah, I mean, I've written several articles about this. Well, I'll give you an example. So in one piece I wrote, which is Bayesian counter-apologetics, I address this question of the moral argument, which is the attempt to prove that God exists through the fact that moral facts exist. And the key thing there, this is the argument that I make there, which is that if atheism is true, it is still true that first, we all want to live in a just and kind and honest world. And that desire by itself is sufficient reason for us to try and create one. Basically, if you don't want the world to be amoral, then you already have sufficient reason to be moral to actually start participating in creating the society you want to exist. And that doesn't have to require anything other than the system itself. And secondly, we are social animals. And in fact, social animals need to be just and kind and honest to work together well. And they need to work together well to optimize their own survival and realize their goals, which go beyond just mere survival. In fact, you only need to compare moral societies with immoral societies to see the difference. And that observation is more than sufficient reason to be moral, which is how we've actually progressed morally. We've actually tinkered with our moral values, seen what didn't work, seeing what did work, and then picked that up and ran with it and saw how societies improved when we changed the actual behavior that we actually advocated as moral within that society. And on top of all of that, more and deeper joy and satisfaction comes from feeling compassion with others and loving truth, whereas loving falsehood, by contrast, will always result in embracing self-defeating or self-frustrating behaviors, while compassion is necessary to vicariously experience in the joy and happiness of others. So atheism predicts actually three motivating reasons for people to develop a common morality centered around compassion, honesty, justice, and cooperation, because that's good for them. And more importantly, atheism predicts that moral rules will only come from human beings, and thus they'll begin deeply flawed, and they'll improve by experiment over a really long time, each improvement coming after empirically observing the social discomfort and satisfaction and waste that comes from flawed moral systems. So atheism also predicts that that will happen only slowly over thousands of years because humans are imperfect reasoners. And this is the thing. This is exactly what we observe. Just look at the examples of slavery and the subordination of women in the Bible, for example. Look how many thousands of years it took us to fix those problems, to actually recognize that those actually made societies worse and we didn't like that society. We wanted to live in a better society. So we changed the rules, tested them out, and found better ways to organize society. So by contrast, though, theism would predict a universe either directly governed by justice laws or a kind and just stewardship or the enacting and teaching of divine justice and mercy everywhere from the start. But we observe no such laws built into the universe. There are no stewards or law enforcers other than us. And there's no perfect moral code that has existed anywhere throughout history. The best moralities have always just slowly evolved from human trial and error. And I don't mean biologically evolved. I mean evolved through cultural evolution, meaning humans are experimenting, trying, fixing, and tinkering. So the evidence of human morality, the fact that morality started abysmal and was only slowly improved by humans over thousands of years through trial and error, just looking at evidence, in the direction that would make their societies better for them, that's what we expect on atheism. It's not at all what we expect on God. So not only do we not need God to explain where we get our moral ideas for what we're actually looking for in terms of looking for the best moral system, but actually the evidence of history shows that there hasn't been a God involved at all in this process.
So would it be fair to say that you're using the outcome to, you're basically saying that the outcome of our preference for joy, our preference for love, our preference for kindness, these outcomes are actually something that you're using to set as the standard themselves?
Well, I am a consequentialist. So in that sense, yes, I think that the measure by which we would tell whether a moral system is good or bad is the question of the consequences that enacting that moral system has on the social system and whether that ultimately is good for us as individuals, as moral agents participating in the system. And we can be wrong about this. We can have false beliefs about what we think is best for us and not realize that we are engaging in self-defeating behaviors, not realize that we are cutting ourselves off from sources of joy and pleasure, and not realizing that we're making our own lives miserable, but thinking we're doing better. So we can have false beliefs about this, but that's what actually the differences between subjective and objective moral facts are, that the objective truth is what follows from what's actually true, regardless of what false beliefs you have. So the standard is what is going to lead to every individual living the most self-satisfying life, the most satisfying life, being the most satisfied with who they are without false beliefs. And that's tricky to have both those things together, to have only true beliefs about yourself and the world and live the most satisfied life. There's only one path, or maybe a few, that are equally good, but there's certainly very few ways to organize what you're going to consider as the best action that's going to realize and navigate that and lead to your greatest self-satisfaction with the most true beliefs.
Now, Richard, how would you argue, though? I mean, how can you say that? What if a person decides that being greedy is a good thing? And we certainly know that there have been dictators in the world, and even we could look at our current president. I mean, there are certain features where we can see that people say, hey, I get a lot of joy when I'm greedy. Or maybe when I'm very selfish, I find a lot of joy.
Yeah.
I don't find joy when I'm selfless.
That's
just saying that you're looking at the outcome, but the way that people arrive at that outcome can vary quite a bit person to person.
And that's all. A lot of that's based on false beliefs. In fact, like we have psychology showing that people who pursue money, for example, rather than other things, end up much more miserable than other people. Like, their actual happiness quotient is not that great. They actually end up like angry, paranoid people, fearful, disappointed, dissatisfied with life. These people just have false beliefs about what is actually making them better. If you look at Trump, I mean, look at what the paranoid, unhappy guy that is. Like, who would want to be that man? I don't know. So a lot of people who would want to have his wealth, but of course they would use it differently than he would. And that's the difference, really. And I just think he's just caught in the delusion of false beliefs. And that's what makes him such an unhappy, angry man. Unless, of course, he's a total sociopath, in which case he has a psychological problem. He's actually mentally ill in that event. But I'll leave that for a whole side discussion as what we do with sociopaths. But people who don't have mental illnesses that impair their moral judgment, people who can actually come to true beliefs about the world and about themselves, and people who can actually realize compassion, actually enjoy, for instance, the vicarious joy of bringing pleasure to others, and who actually love truth, actually find that that's a great thing to value in their life. People who pursue those values end up way happier and more satisfied with their lives on average. Now, I have to mention, this is also a risk theory, right? So it's a question of whether you're a good gambler or a bad gambler. And dictators tend to be bad gamblers. Some of them might have gotten lucky, but that doesn't mean it's a good path to follow, because odds are you're going to end up dead or miserable, and you're not going to end up in that position. So the question is what is actually going to improve the odds of our most self-satisfying life? And that relates a lot to how we see ourselves too. Do we have honest picture of ourselves, or are we lying to ourselves about what we think about ourselves and who we really are? If you have true beliefs about yourself, if you really believe things about yourself, who you are and what you represent and how you act, and those beliefs are true, there's going to be much more limits on what you will actually enjoy doing that will actually limit the kind of ways that people think lead to immorality. In fact, you're going to be a more moral person because it simply leads to you feeling better about yourself.
Well, let me go back to that, because I mean, if we look at that same argument, we could look at someone like Stalin. Now, Stalin was perfectly content with himself. He died a happy man, probably shaking his fist at God. But all Stalin also to the contrary. Murdered the people. So
he was massively paranoid. Oh my God, Stalin was an angry, paranoid man who was completely obsessed and consumed with the kinds of fears that had created for himself. I think the psychological profile of Stalin is not of a guy I would want to be by any means. And I don't think anyone who has true and honest beliefs about the world, anyone who has true beliefs about the world is not deluded, would not want to be Stalin by any means. And that's the whole point, is that that's actually bad for human self-satisfaction.
I agree with you. I agree. You and I are on the same exact page on I value love. I value joy. I have the same exact values as you do and what you think is important. This is true. I'm just saying that there's a grounding for it. And the grounding is God. And there's also a moral lawgiver who basically stands as the person who created these laws and the idea that, for example, we want to be thankful. We want to forgive. These aren't explained by our biology.
Actually, they are.
Why did we get like this? Well, let me actually, before you do that, I want to go back to one point that you did make that I haven't been able to mention anything yet. One thing you said, and I agree with you, money does not bring happiness. In fact, I grew up in a place in the I remember in the 80s, there were a lot of people who had these signs all around that said, "He who dies with the most toys wins." And that's just not true. But that was something that our materialist society tends to be like. But what they found is some of the societies in which people do have money, like if you look at the World Value Surveys with Ron Engelhardt, a lot of the very wealthier, the wealthier societies tend to have happier people. A lot of the Northern European societies are considered pretty happy. And Finland, for example, is considered very happy. And they tend to have higher levels of wealth. So they're not the very poor countries.
Correct. But these are not people who value greed very much, though. These people have good social systems. They actually are some of the most moral societies that we can observe. When you actually look at the markers of social satisfaction, personal satisfaction, and social functionality, for example, you can look at crime rates, for instance. Huge difference between Finland, Sweden, and the United States, which just skyrockets on all these markers of social dysfunction. So the wealth that they have, actually, that's including the social safety nets that they have, the socialism that they have enacted in those societies that actually solve a lot of the problems that make people's lives miserable. One of those problems is not having to endlessly pursue money and work 80 hours a week just to get by. You don't have to do that there. And obviously, you're going to be happier in that environment. And they did it by being more moral about how they organize their society and how they treat each other.
I'll agree with you on a lot of points with that. So I've done a lot of studies on what's going on over there. And I've taken a look at, for example, the World Value Surveys. And you can say that, why are these people happy? What's going on over there? And it's not, they're not full socialists. And so on that point, I'm not going to agree with you. They're social democracies.
No, I didn't mean to imply that they were like,
but you're right. They have very strong welfare systems. For example, if you're in Sweden and you get pregnant, you get a year of paid maternity leave. And I have friends who went through university systems over there and we're just kept getting pregnant and kept getting a year off and pregnant again. I know there's one girl I knew who had five kids and she basically had 5 years completely paid for by the, I mean, it's a very good society with that in that respect, as far as valuing families and valuing work-life balance.
And this gets to what I think the grounding of morality is, which is how the world just actually works, how things actually are. And these societies are societies that experimented with different ways of organizing, different ways of defining what's moral and what's right, and found different versions of doing this that actually lead to everything being better for everybody. So that there's actually motive and incentive there. And that's also that's what we're trying to figure out, is what is the best way to define what you ought most to do that will result in an environment and a social system that you can benefit from the most, that you'll be happiest in. And that is simply, that just follows from the facts on the ground of how social systems work, how human psychology works, how physics works. The whole idea of morality of food distribution is simply a function of the fact that people need food. If we lived in a world where people didn't need food, there wouldn't be any moral facts about the need for food, for example. So these facts all follow from just the nature of the universe and the way it is, and it would always do so. So there'd be any universe you pick, there's going to be some moral system that's going to be true in that universe that's going to follow from and be grounded in just the facts of that universe, of just how it works. And you don't need a God for that, is the point I'm getting at.
Well, see, that's where I disagree, because I think the very fact that we have these values of, for example, we have preferences and values for things like gratitude and forgiveness and truth, mercy, justice, equality, all of these very good values that we have to ask, why didn't we come to value their counterparts? I mean, if you go back to Plato and you look at his book, Republic, you're going to see a great example of where, what happens if society evolved to prefer selfishness? I mean, certainly if we go and we look at Darwin and survival of the fittest and adaptability, yeah. That's suck. Certainly that's a possibility.
Well, yeah, I agree that's with the
you.
Point.
But you have why. To, you have to understand that, and I know you can say, well, we can look around and this is just how it is. That's sort of like a Sam Harris would do in his moral landscape. He looks around and he says, you know, he looks at epistemology and he says, this is just how it is. Like, we can look around and say that, but it's not explaining the foundation upon which we've grounded these beliefs. There's no foundation in the way that you're believing. There's no system that you can use to say, hey, I can go back and judge the Nazis as being wrong, because I can judge them against, I can judge them against truth, justice, where they people traded fairly. I can judge against equality. People were not being treated in an equal way. I can judge against a standard of love. The Jews were not being treated in a very loving way. And so we know based on these standards, and the standards are grounded in God. So the reason why we tend to prefer the right standards and these very kind, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you sort of standards is because God has actually created those. And that's one reason why that particular idea, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is in all religions. All major religions actually endorse some form of that value.
Well, it's just the golden principle, the golden that's, rule. You're just stating a fact of how social systems work. You don't need a God for that to be the case. Game theory works regardless of whether gods exist. It's not even in there. The fact is, like, Nazi organized societies suck. Yeah. Like, people don't like them. They're horrible for people. And very few people get to benefit from them at all. And most of those people have to live a lie. They have to live false beliefs about themselves and the world, even to sustain them. So they're not sustainable on any model of truth. Whereas if you look at the true facts of the world, what social system can be organized that everyone was going to be happy in? It's not going to be Nazis. It's going to be the society where we have things, where we have relief for emotional needs like forgiveness and repentance and mercy and gratitude and all of this stuff. These are things that we actually understand evolved. We have evolved emotional bases for because we're a social animal. They're actually useful and necessary for the effectiveness of any social system. And if you try to purge them from the social system, you get shitty systems that break down and are dysfunctional and are worse for everyone in them. And so this is just a fact of how social systems work. It doesn't require a God to tell us this. We can actually find it out through evidence. We can actually experiment with different systems, look through history and cultures and see which systems had which results and actually see what actually works and what doesn't. And it work, what works and what doesn't is not the result of God meddling and making it that way. It's the result of the fact that that's how systems work. And it's just the way the world is. And the world would be some way, whether any world we were in, it would be some way. And there would be some moral system that would therefore follow from that system. It's always going to be grounded in the facts of the world. And so you'll never need a God to explain any of it. In fact, the most a God could do is skip the evidence part and say, here, let me give you a list of all the things you'll find if you go experimenting empirically to find out the best systems. We could take that list and we could quickly take that as a cheat sheet, go test it and find out, yeah, he's right. Every single one of these is the best way to organize society and then run with it. But then all he's done is tell us what we would have found out eventually anyway after thousands more years of experimenting and figuring it out. He would have just told us facts about the world. They wouldn't be true because he said them. They would be true because that's how the world works.
So I agree with you that, but I wanted to go back to what I brought up a little bit earlier today, and I mentioned the fact that in the United States, for example, there's very high levels of self-enhancement values versus in other places of the world where there are very high levels of self-transcendent values and benevolence and universalism. Mm-hmm. So you have what is. If we look at your explanation of biology and psychology and that kind of stuff, we can both look at what is going on here in the United States. And I know you're also in the United States, or we can look at what ought to be. And so the ought to be in every case is always different than the what is. So where did these ought to be? Where did our moral duties come from if we have no firm foundation that provided those moral duties besides just our decisions? I mean, people don't get together and say, okay, let's devise our moral systems. We certainly create laws and things like that, but we don't get together and analyze other cultures and previous cultures, but if you look anywhere in the world, humans know, for example, that and unlike animals, humans aren't like animals, so we don't kill other humans, we murder them, and we don't take food from our neighbors, we steal it. And so those are moral duties that came from some source. And so I'm just, you and I are obviously have a fundamental disagreement on the source.
Yeah, no,
I think contrived within our minds, but
I think you're missing what I'm saying, though. If you look, for example, the difference in values between the U.S. and other places, look how dysfunctional U.S. society is. We have actual empirical measures that U.S. society sucks objectively in certain ways that other societies we could point to don't suck. And that's not that those societies are free of sucky things. It's just that clearly there's something they're doing right that we're doing wrong. And when you get down to it, it's exactly what you're talking about, like balance of values, what we actually prioritize and things like that. We have false beliefs about what will actually make the society that we're in better for ourselves. And consequently, we end up engaging in self-defeating behaviors. And that's the grounding of it. And it comes down to like, what ought you do above all else? And there's only one answer to that we can identify, which is that what will lead to you being most satisfied about yourself having done. And if you want to talk about what does that while being true, in other words, so there's no false beliefs involved in it, you end up with moral facts. And it's simply a question of what is going to result in a society that you would want to live in? What is going to result in a version of you that you would be comfortable with? And these are all facts of human psychology and facts of the social system we're dealing with. So we don't need, there isn't any role for a God to explain any of this to us. I mean, he could be useful and come down and tell us what the best set of rules are, rather so that we don't have to spend centuries more still tinkering to figure it out. And so we don't have these disputes. So we don't have millions of Americans with deluded false beliefs about what actually is the best way to live. It would be handy to have a God come down and explain to us what we're doing wrong. But his explanation of what we were doing wrong would simply be an explanation of what it would take for us to make our society better and to make us feel better about ourselves without having false beliefs. And that's all he would be explaining to us, which would be the case whether God exists or not. So we don't need God to ground that, any of that. The facts of the world, the facts about us ground that. There are no other facts relevant to what actually is going to make us happier about ourselves and what is going to make our societies work better for us.
Yeah, but so, you can say, you've got people, you're just saying what would work for us, what we decided, what false, you said it's a false belief if somebody decides that money's better or somebody decides that selfishness or greed are better.
That's just a false belief. Let me be
how
clear.
How can you determine with your non-standard, how can you determine that it's a false belief?
It's not a non-standard, it's the only standard. It's even your standard, incidentally, but we'll get to that.
No, I know it's my standard, but I'm saying it's definitely not everybody's standard. Just
for someone to believe that pursuing money is going to work out best for them, for that it'll make them live a more satisfied life and be more satisfied with themselves as a person, that is a false belief because it is simply not true. That if they pursue that path, they're going to end up with the opposite result. Whereas if they follow a different path, they're going to be more satisfied with their lives and more satisfied with themselves. That's simply a fact. That doesn't require a God to be true. It's just a fact of what's going to happen when you live a certain way. And that is a fact of yourself psychologically, and it is a fact of the system you're in.
I think you're throwing it out as if it's a fact, but we can certainly, have you seen studies that they've indicated that every single person who pursues money is unhappy? I can think of a lot of people coming from a place I lived in Boca Raton. If you go to Boca Raton,
false beliefs don't count here.
Pursuing money.
If someone has a deluded idea of themselves, they have false beliefs about themselves, then what they think they're doing is false as well. If they think that is the best thing they could be doing, it's false. So you can't have moral facts following from false beliefs. So we can only get true moral facts from true beliefs, which means you have to have true beliefs about yourself. Now, when you get into that position where you've actually self-examined and you actually have a true and accurate picture of who you are and who you've become, this is going to have significant effects on what kinds of things that you can do and still be satisfied with yourself and still be satisfied with your life. And that is actually the self-reflection and the transcendence that you're talking about, the value for more transcendent thinking in other cultures. That is actually the effect of that on people, is that they start to realize if they have true beliefs about themselves, there are actually only very few paths left that will actually realize that best happiness and satisfaction for themselves. And that ends up being moral behavior. It ends up creating better societies with more happy people in them.
So let me go back to, you just distinguished true and false beliefs. So how do you distinguish, like, what is a false belief? So if I can make a list here, because I think that your true beliefs might be consistent with what I call objective moral standards. And I think your false beliefs are the equivalent of what the opposing values would be to those standards. I just want to see if that's the case. So what would you say are the true factual beliefs?
About what, though? Like, so well, you if you want said, a definition of said, truth, I mean...
Well, no, you just said that there are people have true beliefs or they have false beliefs. One of the false beliefs is the pursuit of money.
That corresponds with fact. So it corresponds with what is actually the case.
Okay,
so false belief means you believe something that is not the case. You believe something is the case that is not the case. That is what a false belief is. So if you believe that you are a generous person, but you're actually a total miser, you have an objectively false belief. Your belief about yourself is false. Because it is not the case. You believe something is the case about yourself that is actually not the case about you. And that's a false belief. Whereas if you come to a true belief about yourself and you actually hate misers and you realize, oh shit, I'm a freaking miser, you would actually come to dislike yourself. You'd realize I am the kind of person I dislike. And you would not be able to live a self-satisfied life. You would not be able to be satisfied with yourself. You would realize I have become the kind of person I hate, and I'm going to hate myself if I keep being this way. So I need to become the person I like. The kind of people I like to see in the world, the kind of people I like to interact with, that way I can actually like myself. So self-satisfaction requires true beliefs about yourself, and it requires you to actually find a satisfying way to be who you are. And if you don't like who you are, you've got to change who you are. And that leads to changes in values, changes in behavior.
Can I interject just for one sec, just because I think I have a bit of an understanding of SJ's position. She brought up that we were hedonistic. Well, no, I'm Canadian, so not me. And for the record, we get 18 months of maternity leave here.
Do you really?
We do.
Wow.
We do.
Canada for the win.
That's right. I forgot. Both of you are from Canada.
Yeah. So anyway, so you brought up hedonism in the U.S. So essentially, I think what you're trying to get to is that if Richard is correct and you are, in fact, it is a true fact about you, and you believe that you're a hedonist, and you're okay with that, that's going to lead to what you would define as moral decay, because you're going to be doing what the four of us in this group would consider to be morally reprehensible behaviors, like using other people and only caring about yourself. So even within that framework, potentially, just to play a little bit of devil's advocate here, If it's a true belief that you're hedonistic and you're okay with being hedonistic and you want to pursue that within that moral system, what does that look like? Because if that moral system is true, that could lead to what we would consider dangerous moral decay. Is that fair, SJ?
Yeah, that's fair. And I think that's a good point. And let me just quickly add to that. It kind of reminds me of what Sam Harris said when he was talking about the desire for well-being and to maximize pleasure and happiness, because pleasure easily could be viewed as hedonistic in some ways.
Right. So Richard, would you ever respond for that? I just felt like there was a lot of back and mm-hmm. forth, and that might have been a more concise synopsis to just
yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things that came up, but that was one important topic to bring up. The false assumption there is that hedonism logically entails only thinking about yourself, selfishness. If you pursue hedonism in that way, it's going to be self-destructive. You're not going to live a self-satisfying life that way. Certainly not in conjunction with true beliefs about yourself and about the world. I am a hedonist, but I realize that I cannot enjoy the benefits and the satisfying qualities of hedonism if I only care about myself. I actually have to, there are a variety of reasons why I need to care about other people. I need to care about my effect on the world simply to manage and make possible the realization of the pleasures that I want in my life, basically. So I do have obligations to other people. If I don't act on those obligations to other people, it will result in negative consequences at a disproportionate rate compared to any other behavior. So it actually is not in my best interest. It's just like someone who thinks they're a hedonist. They think, well, I need fancy wines. I need to drink $200 bottles of wine. Objectively, factually, there's no significant taste difference between a $200 bottle of wine and a decent $15 bottle of wine. So a hedonist who thinks that they're actually getting more pleasure out of a $200 bottle of wine, they think they need that, they just have a false belief. If they actually sat down and compared this stuff, they'd realize, holy shit, I'm wasting money. And of course, by wasting money, they're making their life worse. And so I think it's these kinds of things where you have to pursue true beliefs about yourself, And you actually have to realize that you can achieve your goals. You can achieve satisfying outcomes in life, whatever they may be, whether they're pleasures or whatever. You can't achieve those things in isolation from the social system you're in. You actually have to cultivate loving relationships, neighborly relationships, reliable business relationships. You have to actually cultivate community relationships, democratic relationships, voting relationships with your entire country. You actually have to do these things simply to maintain the environment that makes it possible for you to actually live a long life and enjoy satisfying life, even as a hedonist. So these are the things. And there's another aspect to it as well, of course. As a hedonist, compassion is a really important source of pleasure. And I think that people who don't realize that are cutting out a huge part of opportunities for their life. And they're actually cutting out, they have a big hole in terms of the sort of pleasures and satisfactions they could have in their life. So if you're actually to compare the options, the two lives they live, one with compassion and the one without, one of those lives is going to be more satisfying than the other. And it's going to be the one that has more compassion in it. And so that's, and this is just a fact of human psychology. It's a fact of social systems. It's a fact how the world works. And this is what we've discovered. It's taken us thousands of years, but we slowly figured this out over time. There may yet be still more things that we need to figure out, but we figured out a lot of things. We've tinkered with a lot of societies. We've looked back in the past and we see how shitty the results are. And we see there's better ways to organize society, better ways to live our own lives, to actually make decisions for ourselves that actually result in better outcomes for ourselves and for the systems we have to rely on for our own outcomes for ourselves as well. And this is just facts on the ground. This is how things are. Like, at no point does it ever contact God or any need to talk to a God.
So, yeah, I have a question for SJ too. You've mentioned that these must be imparted upon us somehow. My question would be, you know, if you would be referencing the Bible. From my perspective, it's very ambiguous because, you know, it's a large book and it's sometimes convoluted and it can be contradictory, and it refutes itself in places. So how do you know what within that book are the objective moral facts? How are they imparted upon us, and how are they imparted upon people who have never been exposed to it or believe in a different book or none at all?
Well, thank you. That's actually a great question. So I would, if as a Christian, the moral exemplar for us is Jesus Christ. So God sent Jesus Christ, and one of the theories of why God sent Jesus Christ, you know, when they look at the atonement, one of the theories is related to the fact that he serves as a moral exemplar. So he's an exemplar of being kind, obedient, humble, a servant leader. Actually, one of the things I'm starting to do a lot of my research on now, and I'm writing an HR textbook, for example, and one of the inclusions I'm going to have is on servant leadership. But Jesus is the servant leader, and all of the different features that he had. He was honest, he persevered, he was bold in a lot of ways. He was forgiving. He forgave a lot of people. I mean, just at the last minute, he said, "Forgive them, Father. They know not what they do." So he was the example of every single moral value that we hold true as Christians. So I just look to Jesus Christ, and I say that he is the perfect example. He is that to which I aspire.
Does that make it objective? The fact that you recognize, could that potentially be you recognizing something that you feel innately based on, you know, your psychology and existing within society in his character, and attaching objective morality to that feeling of connection between him as a character?
I think if we had to have any example throughout history, and you could look at all of the other religions and all of the other people who brought the other religions forward, if there's any other example of someone who is quite like Jesus, I'd love for someone to point them out. To me, he is the objective standard. So if we want to know exactly how to live and be just and be merciful, we can look to him. He laid his life down for us. He basically reconciled the whole idea of God's perfect justice and God's perfect mercy all in one move. He's an objective standard. Now, when I say objective, you can judge people's actions against it. One thing that you brought up before was slavery. and how slavery has varied over the centuries. And unfortunately, we saw the worst form of slavery in the antebellum slavery of the United States. So we saw a horrible form of that. And the thing that we do with our objective morality is we can judge that practice. So slavery is a practice. We can judge that against those same objective standards. So we can judge them against the standards of justice, fair, you know, justice and the standard of equality, the standard of liberty. Liberty is another one that, that Thomas Jefferson mentioned a long time ago. But we can judge different practices by these standards. And so that's something that we can also look to.
Why did Jesus never condemn slavery, even though more than half the population around him were slaves?
That's a good question. And I think one of the things that one of the ways there's a two ways to answer this. One thing that I think you should look at is the fact that all of the surrounding societies in that time were using slaves, and it was one of the means to sustain their economic systems. And so that was something that was very common in the time. So Jesus didn't come to bunk, you know, debunk the government or debunk current systems.
Come to stand up for objective moral values. He didn't teach people that it is immoral to keep slaves and to treat slaves as they're treating them.
Actually, a really good example of that is Onesimus. So if we look at exactly
that's not
what
Jesus,
Paul,
I would point out, that's not
well,
Jesus.
We're well, talking about Jesus. Jesus did work through Paul, and Paul made that quite clear throughout his epistles. Well,
and even in Onesimus, Paul does not say we got to get rid of slaves or that slavery is immoral. He just actually tries to convince Onesimus to give him the one slave.
You have to, and Richard, I know that you're extremely familiar with this time period because that's what your history is on, but you have to admit that slaves were prevalent throughout all societies back then.
We even have Musonius Rufus, who actually I would compare with Jesus in terms of moral values. In fact, I think he actually has better arguments than Jesus for a lot of things. But Musonius Rufus actually argued that we shouldn't have slaves, that actually if you want something, you should work for it yourself. Why don't we have a statement like that from Jesus? This is supposed to be the guy who's supposed to be conveying to us the most important set of moral truths ever. How did he miss that?
Well, he didn't miss it, actually, Richard. There's two things I want to mention. One thing that Jesus gave us two commandments. He basically said, love God above all else and love your neighbors as yourselves. And so if we're to obey those commandments, those reach out to just about any practice that you can see humans doing. And so the idea of treating others unfairly and enslaving them.
But he gives this whole Sermon on the Mount, which is this vast dissertation on how you should behave. And somehow he doesn't come up, oh, by the way, you should get rid of all your slaves or you should manumit your slaves because slavery is immoral. That didn't make the list at all.
Well, you, again, Richard,
he went out of his way to say you need to pray in private in your closet, not in public. He thought that was more important to tell people, which Christians don't do, by the way. But it was more important for him to tell people to do that than to tell them that they need to manumit slaves and work to free slaves.
If you actually look at the treatment of with Paul and Onesimus, we saw a great example of Paul saying, well, listen, here's how we're going to treat our brothers. He referred to Onesimus.
Well, only who was one slave.
That's the only slave that's in the New Testament that we even have mention of. We have Onesimus mentioned by name in the New Testament.
Other than all the analogies that Jesus talks about.
But Richard, if you want to see.
Jesus gives instructions on how to treat slaves. He said, I believe the quote, and I'm probably going to paraphrase, is that he's telling people that his instructions to slaves were to treat their masters well and to treat their Jewish masters especially well. So that's Jesus directly referencing.
No, that's Paul. I think
is that Paul?
Paul, oh, okay. Paul has instructions. Yeah, Paul is very explicit in saying we keep your slaves and be obedient as slaves. And or at least it's Paul or pseudo Paul. I can't remember which letter it's in. But in any case, it wasn't in the Gospels. It's particularly weird that Jesus never runs into any slaves in the Gospels. That's one of the reasons we can tell it is fiction. But this is, I think, getting on a sidetrack on this. I think if you want to get back on what we're actually supposed to be debating, I can pivot with this. I can give you a question differently. Let's just assume for the sake of argument, I don't agree with it, but let's assume for the sake of argument that the character of Jesus depicted in the Gospels is a moral exemplar, that someone nailed it, that someone got it right. How do you know that? Like, why is that a better moral example than Buddha or Musonius Rufus or Epicurus or Gandhi or what standard, as you were asking earlier, do you tell that this is the best moral exemplar of all the moral exemplars that we could pick? what is it that you use to determine that? How do you know that this is a good one?
Well, I look at exactly how he treated people. And I don't know, to be honest, I don't know everything that's about Gandhi's life. I don't know everything about Buddha's life. And I probably could say maybe they were great people and maybe they did a lot of the right things. I do know just about everything that I can find on Jesus's life in the Gospels. And I say that what he's done, as far as any value that we hold true, is he's basically served as the epitome of it. And so if Gandhi did a great job morally, and if he, you know, and I'm somewhat familiar with him and I'm somewhat familiar with Buddha, but I don't know their entire lives. And I do know from the Bible that it says all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So I would assume that Gandhi and Buddha had made mistakes at one point. And I know that Jesus had never sinned. So Jesus was the Passover lamb.
Yeah, I'm going to let that go. Because as a matter of history, that's all kinds of questions could be raised there, but I want to stick to the meta ethical question and not the historical documentary question. But what you've just said is that you like Jesus. You like how he behaves, and that. But how is that your standard? How does what you like determine what is objectively true? Like, I'm trying to have you connect the dots here. Like, how do you determine that this is not just some guy you like, but is also you think this is actually, yes, everyone ought to behave this way? What connects those dots for you? How do you get there?
Richard, that's so interesting that you're using this argument, because it sounds exactly like what you were just arguing for yourself. You just said, you spent the first 45 minutes saying what's in your best interest actually is what basically is your moral foundation.
Are you agreeing with that, or do you have a different dot connection? That's what I'm trying to get at.
So you're saying what's in my best interest is Jesus my standard? So yes, Jesus is my standard.
Why is Jesus your standard? What is your standard that you're using to determine that Jesus is the best? Like, you can't just say Jesus is the best. Like, there's got to be a reason that you're choosing. Why? How do you tell someone this is the best? And someone comes along and says, no, I disagree. I think this other example is the best. What's your argument to them? It's like, no, you're wrong. This one's right. What is your argument? I know what my argument is. I'm trying to get at what yours is. If it's not grounded in the facts of reality, what is it grounded? You're saying it's grounded in God, but that doesn't explain why that makes it good.
Well, let me look at it this way. So I named some objective moral standards. If I wanted to figure out how to live my life, I could take those same moral standards that I named earlier, and I could add to them things like forgiveness, you know, mercy, that idea. I could add to the idea of gratitude. I could add to the idea of obedience and servitude and serving as a servant leader. And then I can go back to Jesus and understand that his entire life was perfect in the 3 years that we know about in his ministry. All of the things that he did through his parables and his teachings and his beatitudes that he taught, but basically was serving as the example.
On what basis are you saying that he is perfect? I understand that he meets this list that you have. I'm asking you, how do you sell that list as being the best list? I mean, based on anything other than just your subjective opinion, right? So like you believe in objective truth. So what makes that list the best list is what I'm saying. Like I'm trying to get below that.
But Richard, the thing foundation. Is you hold those same exact values to be self-evident as well.
I know, I know how I would answer the question. I'm trying to figure out how you answer the question.
But you hold the values of equity and equality you hold those to be self-evident, to be axiomatic.
I just spent a whole long time explaining how they're not self-evident. They're actually evident.
Oh, discoverable. So you think that they're discoverable.
We have evidence.
That's probably where we differ then. So I think that they're self-evident. I think that they're innately hardwired within us. And you would say that they're...
That's the thing is like, even if they're... Because you just said earlier, like, if we evolved certain values, and we did to a certain extent, but it's totally true that merely having evolved a certain moral mechanism in the brain does not in and of itself make that morally right. It might just be something that's just there for whatever reason. But you're saying that you have like this intuitive feeling that these are right. But how do you know that intuitive feeling is correct and not just something random that got punched into you by spirits or nature or whatever? Like, how is it that you're determining that that's good and not just some arbitrary selection of values?
I mean, I think it's something that's is far as even when you're a little kid that you sort of just realize that it's better to tell the truth. It's better to do that. But that's ways that you come to it in your way. But actually also just looking at these values and going back to what Thomas Jefferson said, to me, it's axiomatic. It is part of what we are as humans. We all know we have this desire of what we ought to do, and what we ought to do, the vast majority of any sane humans, we ought to do what's right. And what is right is consistent with what holds against this standard, and the standard is of love. And so love, truth, justice, equity, gratitude, all that kind of stuff.
How do you know that? I mean, I agree with you. And I know how we know that, like how the rest of us know this. I just don't understand how you know that. You seem to just have, you're claiming magical knowledge that somehow you just magically know it, but you can't actually argue for it. You have no argument for this being a better moral system than any other.
I think what we're doing here is we're talking right now at the individual level. So how does S.J. Thomason know something versus how does Richard know something? Sure. How does Shannon know something? How does Mike know something? We're looking here at the level of the individual. What I'm trying to tell you. Well, that's why earlier I started off talking about, yes, we actually are also hardwired with certain personality characteristics. For example, going back to the five-factor model, we have a predisposition to be agreeable, for example, based on if our parents were agreeable. So we are more likely to be agreeable. And the reason I mentioned that specific characteristic is because within agreeableness is the dimension of altruism.
This attribute varies in the population hugely.
Right, it does.
So what makes your version of it, as opposed to, like, let's say there's a dial of agreeableness, what makes the setting for you the correct setting? And then everyone else should somehow turn their dial to that setting. Like, I'm not saying that.
I'm not saying that at all. What I'm trying to say is that I'm saying we need to
look at altruism.
Altruism.
Why should someone set their dial for altruism somewhere?
Richard, hear me out, okay?
I don't understand your position.
Listen to me. I know you have to hear at least hear the whole thing.
Okay.
So at the individual level, right? We're predisposed to a certain extent to have some of the similar personality characteristics as our parents. So there's a probability that we're going to act in certain ways based on the way that we're wired personality-wise. But if you take a look that's at the individual level. Now, if we go to the cultural level, based on the culture in which we're raised, we're more likely, again, more probable in the United States, for example, to enhance self-enhancement and hedonistic sorts of values. We're more likely to not be terribly restrained on things. That's one of the things that they've done. We've looked at indulgence in the United States. We're much more likely to be indulgent than in other societies. So that's at the mm-hmm. societal level. What I'm trying to say is at the global level, we also have these desires at the global level, looking at, say, 7 billion people. The vast majority of the 7 billion people, and I say vast majority as in probably 99% or maybe at least 97%, we'll throw the sociopaths and the psychopaths out. The vast majority of people at the global level have these desires of what we ought to do versus what we are doing. So we have our is, and we can see that at the cultural level, and we can even see that at the individual level. But when we look at the global level, we've got the is principle versus the ought principle. The is principle is explained by biology. The ought to do, like we ought to do the right thing for others. We ought to be honest. We ought to be just. We ought to be equitable. No, so
this wasn't the case for slavery. So, like, where were these global values for thousands of years? Even in the Bible, no one ever in the entire Old Testament and the entire New Testament, no one for 1,000 years of writing, 27 books, not a single one of them ever heard this magical global value of slavery is wrong. But how? I don't understand.
Well, you're pointing to a practice that was prevalent back then, but we can also see lots of examples of
love. We can do that with anything. Like, everything was a practice.
You can find a practice.
We're trying to figure out, like, why you're saying this.
If we're starting to talk over each other, so it's just getting a little bit different.
We're talking in circles. We're not getting anywhere. Okay.
But, all right.
We're almost out of time anyway. But if you had to answer your own question there about the dial, Richard, what would you answer that?
Well, I think that's an empirical question, right? So, like, we do know that you can set the dial too high. Too much altruism actually leads in self-defeating behaviors that actually ruin your life. Too low does the same thing. So it's going to be a question of basically empirical evidence in terms of where we're at. And that's we can look at different societies, where they've set the dial, different individuals, how much can it vary? These are scientific questions, empirical questions, in terms of where we should set it. And that's the only way to figure it out, by the way, is to actually see how it's set at different settings for different societies and see what the outcomes are for the individuals in those societies, and whether different social systems, it would work the same way. And so we actually have to look at the facts on the ground in terms of what will lead to the more satisfying life for everyone in it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, both of you. It was a great chat.
Sure. Yeah.
People watching, please go subscribe to our new channel, The Heathen Hour. I'll put the link in the description. I forgot to do it. we just got a super chat from Sweet Heathen, who says, "Yes, America is so evil. All that disgusting freedom and liberty makes you cover up your women."
It's hyperbole there, but okay, yes.
And we did also get one from Mr. Atheist earlier, but I didn't want to interrupt the chat. Said Mr. Atheist, "Do theists see the irony of bringing up Nazism as proof God is a moral genesis?" So thank you very much for the super chats, guys. Have a great night.